Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the March edition of This Week in State Tax podcast, also known as TWIST. My name is Harley Duncan, and I'm with the state and local tax team in KPMG's Washington National Tax Office. We are using this monthly podcast to augment our regular Monday morning TWIST publication. But this month, rather than focus on one specific development, we're going to talk about a situation we see arising with increasing frequency in which taxpayers take the position that an alternative corporate income tax apportionment formula should be used because the statutory formula produces what they at least consider an inappropriate result. Our guest today is Shirley Sicilian, who is also with the KPMG Washington National Tax SALT practice. Shirley has fashioned a 30-plus year career in state and local tax policy, law, and controversy, including serving as the policy director at the Kansas Department of Revenue and general counsel at the Multi-State Tax Commission, as well as serving the last 10 years as head of SALT controversy at KPMG. Shirley, welcome to the podcast. As I said, we're going to talk about the growing interest in alternative apportionment for corporate income taxes. It's not really a new concept, however, as it's always been available in the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, or UDIPA, as we affectionately know it, was first promulgated in 1957. So Shirley, I think we need to start with some level setting. Could you please then just outline for us what UDIPA says about alternative apportionment and what it requires of a taxpayer that's trying to avail itself of it?
Well, thank you, Harley. Thanks for that introduction. And also, I really appreciate that you're asking for a level set. This really is one of those topics where a solid understanding of the basics goes a long way. And if you're not dealing with it every day, it's absolutely worth a quick refresh. So the main thing to know is that nearly every state legislature has delegated some authority to its tax agency to deviate from the statutory apportionment formula if that's needed to cure distortion for a taxpayer. And yes, many states accomplish this by enacting Model UDIPTA Section 18. And under that UDIPTA Section 18, taxpayer has to show two things. One, that sufficient distortion exists under the standard formula. And two, that the taxpayer's proposed alternative is reasonable. That first requirement, that's the harder of the two. And that's met where the standard formula does not, quote, fairly represent the extent of the taxpayer's business activity in the state. Well, what does that mean? To really understand, we need to back up for a minute and remember what the standard formula is supposed to be doing in the first place. Very obviously, the formula is trying to source for a net income tax. It's not a gross receipts tax, not a property tax, not a payroll tax. It's a net income tax. And income arises under the theory of the unitary business principle. Income is arising from many different business activities, sometimes over more than one tax year. Also, obviously, when a state imposes a tax on something, our Constitution requires that the thing has to be in the state in order for the state to actually tax it. Well, that's the rub, right? It's hard to know where a year's worth of multinational business income is coming from. And this is what the formula is supposed to do. Following U.S. Supreme Court case law dating back to the 1920s, the formula is approximating the share of business income attributable to the state based on the share of the taxpayer's business activities conducted in the state that are generating the income. The idea is if you have 50% of the business activities that generate income in the state, then maybe you have 50% of the business income in the state. The UDIPTA language is actually pretty clear then, if you keep that in mind. To show distortion, a taxpayer needs to show that the standard formula overstates the share of its activity conducted in the state and that those activities conducted outside the state do indeed contribute to income. This EUDIPTA test is actually quite consistent with the constitutional test. Under the Constitution, the formula must, and I'm quoting again, actually reflect a reasonable sense of how income is generated. And while the statutory distortion threshold, there has to be a fair reflection, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Hans Ries tells us that a taxpayer may also be constitutionally entitled to relief if the share of income attributed to the state is out of all appropriate proportion to its transactions and activities in that state. And I'll tell you, Harley, in my experience, I found in bringing the request for alternative apportionment to states that a fair chunk of disagreements up front can be resolved by just addressing some of these basics on what it is you're trying to measure in the first place and getting on the same page with that. And then, of course, you move to, well, have you measured it properly, et cetera, et cetera. But just understanding what you're trying to measure is really a big piece of this.
Thank you for that, Shirley. It is, as usual, when I listen to you, it all seems eminently clear and reasonable, but it rather begs the question of if alternative apportionment has been in EUDIPTA since I was playing Little League Baseball, why are we seeing so much more interest now than we did at least in the last 30 or 40 years prior to this? Is it just we've run out of other things to talk about, or is there really something going on here that's causing more and more interest in can I and how do I get to an alternative apportionment formula?
That's a really good and fun question. We saw a lot of requests for alternative apportionment shortly after EUDIPTA was adopted by the states back in the early days. And there was some reluctance to move into formulary apportionment, and there was a lot of figuring out what all needs to be shown. Then things seemed to quiet down for a while. And there was Mormon in 1979. The court said, well, of course you can have a single sales factor over the Iowa. That seemed to quiet things down because that was a case where the taxpayer had most of its production activity outside of Iowa and a fair amount of sales inside of Iowa and just said, you can't use a single sales factor. You're not taking into account my production activity. The court said that was fine for Iowa to do that, that there's nothing per se unconstitutional with the single sales factor. But they did not say that the taxpayer couldn't make an argument. What they said was the taxpayer had not shown any evidence in that case that its production activity outside of Iowa was actually contributing to income. And while that may sound obvious, that's not enough in court. You have to show some evidence. And what the court said was that hadn't been done. Because of that, though, I think it became pretty quiet. And now there really are three main reasons why we're seeing this come up again. And that's there's been trends in state tax law that are creating more situations where there really is distortion and it really is worth taking a close look at. One of the first reasons most people in our state practice realize that moving from a three-factor equal-weighted formula, moving away from that can create more situations where there's distortion. And today, only five states still use the three-factor equal-weighted formula. The emphasis now is, of course, on the sales factor, which usually does a fine job of reflecting the taxpayer's market activity. The property and payroll factors, which reflected production activity, have been increasingly peeled off in state formulas. There's plenty of public policy rationale to support the state migration to single sales factor, and the U.S. Supreme Court itself has said that a non-arbitrary, non-discriminatory statutory formula, even a very narrow one, will be upheld and will not be found to be per se unconstitutional. But one of the trade-offs in moving to a single sales factor is that from a tax perspective, as opposed to a broader public policy perspective, there may be more need for the state to exercise its alternative apportionment authority. If the share of a taxpayer's production activity is about the same as its market activity in a single sales factor state, no problem. But if not, if the share of market activity is substantially greater than the share of production activity in the state, it's pretty easy to see how there could be an unfair, possibly even unconstitutional, overattribution of income. And the Supreme Court itself has cautioned that the narrower the spectrum of activity included in the formula, the more likely there will be instances where that formula fails to properly reflect a particular taxpayer's activity in the state. I'm going to put this in legal jargon for a moment. What they're saying is that there may be more instances where the statute is unconstitutional as applied to a particular taxpayer, even if it's not per se unconstitutional. So we can expect that when the spectrum of activity covered in the formula narrows like it has across many states, those states' distortion relief statutes are going to play a bigger role. That's the first one. Secondly, just the move to market-based sourcing. Again, there's lots of public policy reason for that. Sales factor numerator sourcing for sales of TPPs always been market-based, and we've really not seen problems with that for the most part, except in situations like I just described. That's because it approximates the location of the taxpayer's market activity to sourcing when the TPP was delivered or shipped. Today, though, most states have also adopted language to focus and narrow their numerator sourcing for sales of services and intangibles also to the location of market activity, as opposed to where it had been sourced, which was to the location of all income-producing activity. It sounds fine, but what's happening is that today there's a lot of technological change, as we're all experiencing, and technological change is creating more situations where a taxpayer, especially service and intangible providers, may not necessarily have a great deal of activity in a market location. The key is the taxpayer's activity that's generating income. It's not the customer's activity. We're just using the market as an idea of where the taxpayer is conducting market activity. But with this technological change, there's less and less activity needed. A good example of this is the MasterCard case in South Carolina. Well, back when the formula also had production factors, this all might have been less of a problem. And this disconnect, though, may create more circumstances now where an alternative way may be needed. So now the third situation, and from my perspective, possibly the main situation we're seeing today, is where there's been a gain on the sale of a business. That gain is making up a large share of the income subject to apportionment, and yet the state has no factors associated with it. This situation developed over decades. I'd say the start came in the early 1990s when we saw a lot of litigation around whether the UDIPTA definition of business income either one, included only transactional test income, or two, also included functional test income, even if that functional income didn't also meet the transactional test. And these two tests are familiar to folks, but just quick refresh. The transactional test, recall, is income arising from transaction and activity in the regular course of the taxpayer's trade or business. And that's income like income from the sale of the taxpayer's goods or services to its customers. And the functional test, though, is income from tangible and intangible property if the acquisition, management, and disposition of the property constitute an integral part of the taxpayer's regular trade or business. So that is production assets or just assets used in the business. A prominent example, though, of income that can often meet a functional test but fail the transactional test is gain on the sale of a business, even a unitary business. Constitutionally, it's fairly well accepted that gain from the sale of unitary business can be included in apportionable income. So the litigation issue in the 90s was mostly with the statutory definition, not the Constitution. Some courts found UDIPTA was a two-test approach, some a one-test, but what happened is that even the one-test states, the legislature often followed up with amendments, making the statute clearly two-test. Many states weren't taking any chances and added a provision that income is apportionable to the full extent allowed under the Constitution. And in 2015, in fact, the MTC recognized that this was a clear trend. Many states had adopted that constitutional approach, and they included this type of language in their model EUDIPTHA rewrite. Several states adopted it. By 2015, this trend to include gain on the sale of a business as business income had pretty much completed its course. And yet today, 10 years later, the impact continues to grow. And the reason, i.e. the problem, is that over those same 10 years, many state statutes moved to single sales factor, but they kept their regulatory language that limits the gross receipts included in the sales factor to just those receipts that are associated with transactional income. So some states move that limitation into their statutes, some just have it in their regs. And some states, it was a little confusing at first because they eliminated the exclusion for gross receipts from occasional sales from their regs, but really it was redundant. And that was the reason for the, or at least one reason for the elimination of that. But as a consequence of all of this is that there will be more need for alternative apportionment. Basically, in a state with a single sales factor, the formula is now reflecting only activities associated with operational income, like market activities around the sale of the taxpayer's goods or services to its customers, and only activities from just the current year. The formula is not reflecting the value realized from the taxpayer's business assets that produce those goods and services. This value was built up over all sorts of other business activities that may have occurred even over multiple prior years or even decades. And these are states that have the transactional test limitation that I'm talking about in their gross receipts factor. So all of this will increase the possibility of distortion if, say, more than 50% of the income subject to apportionment is being sourced based on the location of an activity that's related to less than 50% of the income. And what's happening even more recently is that the situation is being compounded, and that's because we're seeing spikes in M&A activity. 2021 was a high watermark, and future years are expected to also have increased M&A activity after a short downturn after 2021, as interest rates come down and as AI continues to disrupt the different business segments. In an environment like this, we've often seen situations where gain on the sale of a business is making up nearly 30% of the pool of income to be apportioned. We've seen as much as 90% in some situations, and yet there are no factors associated with this income. So that's the type of situation we're seeing a lot of that could very well result in a need for alternative apportionment.
Very good. That helps me understand a lot. The third factor, we've got a broadening of the income that's going to be considered apportionable. Then, as you mentioned in the first two factors, we've got a narrowing of apportionment based on the factors. That's a tension that could well lead to issues of this ain't right, potential distortion. And so you take those two things, and it's just the issue of request for alternative apportionment, potential distortion, the statutory formula is not working appropriately for me. Given my facts and circumstances, how I'm doing business, and the types of activities in which I'm involved. That, to me, makes sense as to why this is kind of rising up now and not so much in my middle-aged years. So I guess then the question becomes, if indeed we begin to understand why they're arising, I don't necessarily see anything that's going to change those three trends to say, well, this will all settle out. As you've worked with clients, are there some approaches or do's and don'ts that you've developed that you think will improve the chances for success if indeed a taxpayer wishes to pursue an alternative apportionment approach to its situation?
Yes, I certainly have quite a bit of experience. The first thing is to actually pay quite a bit of attention to deciding whether you really do want to seek alternative apportionment. You want to compare the difference between what the standard formula is producing versus what you think a reasonable alternative formula would produce. And if there's any doubt about how the standard formula applies, consider instead whether a private letter ruling request would be better. Or maybe kind of a 1-2 approach where first you ask the state, do I understand the statute correctly? And then you could go on to say, if it's not as I understand it, then I need alternative apportionment. So that the PLR option would be sent in simultaneously with a request for alternative apportionment. And then when you're looking at that difference between the standard formula and the proposed formula, you really can't just do a math calculation. You really should think about the probability of success here. It may depend on the degree of difference between those two things. It may depend on the availability of evidence that you have to meet your burden of proof and other things too, like the state's proclivity to grant these types of requests. And some states, a few, not very many, but some do view alternative apportionment requests as completely discretionary, like a request for penalty abatement. And then if you know of any, consider the state's prior treatment of similarly situated taxpayers. The states usually post their decisions on alternative apportionment. You can take a look, see if they've answered a question similar to yours and how they answered it. Other considerations would be the state's authority to grant alternative apportionment. And this kind of veers into Loper-Bright territory. But for the most part, the states do have authority to grant alternative apportionment. So that's one thing. Put a fine point on estimating the actual benefits. Secondly, I would say also pay some attention to really understanding the challenges. There are challenges of timely filing. Some states require that the petition be filed up to 4 months in advance of the original return. That time may have passed. So it's worth taking a look before you do a lot of this work to see which states you really still have an opportunity to file in. Understand the risk of audit. And of course, that's always a risk when you ask the state for money, whether it's a refund request, a PLR, or a petition for alternative apportionment. If the state audits, they're not going to be focused on just this issue. So be aware that could happen and be comfortable with it. It's really crucial to understand the full multi-state picture. Yes, it's true. Different states have different apportionment laws. But if you take a position in one state, what does that mean in other states? And make sure that you understand how an argument in one state might sound in another state and that you're comfortable with that, either under the other state's law or for some other reason. Also, be aware of the potential that the state might counter with its own assertion of distortion, offsetting yours. For example, if your issue is gain on the sale of a business, and if it's a single sales factor state and you have a lot of productive activity there, the state may say, okay, great, and while we're at it, we think there should be a property and payroll factor here. Understand what the potential for that sort of thing is. Also, if you have a great deal of sensitivity around your confidential taxpayer information, be aware that most states will post redacted versions of these rulings. Yes, they're redacted. And yes, almost all states give taxpayers a chance to propose redactions. But ultimately, the redactions that get made are in the hands of the state. So you want to be comfortable with that too, or have figured out if it's worth it, if it's really a problem, whether you would withdraw after all your efforts. But assuming you can get this good with the state's redactions, help the state understand your sensitivities, usually that works out, but it is something to be aware of.
Well, thank you very much, Shirley. I think that's been really educational for me, and I'm sure that it takes some of the mystery out of it for those that are listening. I really appreciate you joining us, and maybe we can do this again sometime. Appreciate it again, Shirley. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next month.
Thank you, Harley.